from deep inside your radio.
By the way, we're launching a probe this week to find out just exactly how deep inside your radio we are. We'll have updates on that as soon as we design the probe. Ladies and gentlemen, what the frack? Last week on this broadcast, I discussed the paradoxical problem of nuclear power plants having to reduce their output during summer when the demand for electricity is at its peak because it's a drought and there's hot weather, and so the water needed for cooling the power plants is not always available. Nutty, huh? Now comes this report. One of the worst droughts in U.S. history is hampering oil production. The recent boom in North American energy production is possible partly by hydraulic fracturing, known as fracking for short. Gets oil and natural gas to flow by cracking shale rock with sand, chemicals, pressure, and water. That was the sound of water, ladies and gentlemen. Hard to believe. Each shale well takes between 2 and 12 million gallons of water to frack. Water that we may never see again, by the way. That disturbs me, because they're not making any more on planet Earth. Anyway, we're having difficulty acquiring water, says Chris Faulkner of Breitling Oil and Gas. No, and he's not in a no-Breitling zone. Faulkner said officials in two Pennsylvania counties have stopped issuing permits for oil companies to draw water from rivers, forcing them to go far afield to obtain their water. That's right. What was a gas boom is turning into a water boom. Farmers used to sell him water for 35 cents a barrel. Now he says they're turning down offers of 75 cents or more. As a result, between 10 and 12% of the wells Breitling planned on fracking have been put on hold. So they're defracking, I guess, at this point. Similar problems are happening at companies industry-wide. There'll be perhaps a 5% reduction in new wells by companies covered by one industry analyst. It's like we need water or something. Ladies and gentlemen, deadlines mean something to you and me, but maybe not to other people. Google disclosed last week in an email to the United Kingdom Information Commissioner's Office it has not yet deleted all user data collected by its Street View camera cars, as it agreed to do more than a year and a half ago. Those vehicles sniffed the content of users' internet communications on Wi-Fi networks. That data was discovered during a manual review of thousands of disks. Human error was blamed for its continued existence. The data was supposed to have been deleted in December 2010, according to a November agreement between Google and the Information Commissioner's Office. It was collected prior to May of that year. Google said it never accessed the data, blaming a single engineer for its collection. A bad apple. The FCC said Google knew its vehicles had collected the data. In any case, haven't deleted it yet. And the Obama administration has failed to meet a legal deadline for scanning all shipping containers for radioactive material before they reach the United States. That would be nice, wouldn't it? That would be good for, I don't know, security. Do we do that? The Department of Homeland Security was given until July to ensure that 100% of inbound shipping containers are screened at foreign ports. But the department secretary, John Napolitano, informed Congress in May she was extending a 2-year blanket exemption to foreign ports because the screening is proving too costly and cumbersome. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's not cumbersome what they do to us in airports, is it? She said it would cost $16 billion to implement scanning measures of the nearly 700 ports worldwide that ship to the United States. Instead, the DHS relies on rolling dice, intelligence gathering and analysis to identify high-risk containers. There you go, psychics, which are checked before being loaded onto ships. Fewer than half a percent of the roughly 10 million containers arriving at U.S. ports last year were scanned before departure. Deadline? Schmedline. Hello, welcome to the show.
With all my blankets in a heap and yellow roses scattered all around.
Sitting watching field hockey in the rain just this very a.m. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, LIBOR, it's more lie than bore. This is written by Douglas Keenan in the Financial Times newspaper. He began trading, he says, for Morgan Stanley, the investment bank, in London in 1991, trading bonds, derivatives, and related securities. One of them was based on the three-month LIBOR rate, the interest rate at which supposedly banks can borrow money for 3 months from each other. I traded a futures contract on the three-month LIBOR rate. This, by the way, is also a rate used as a landmark benchmark for many, many, many other things like credit cards, car loans, mortgages, derivatives, what have you. Or, in this gentleman's case, what don't have you. Anyway, he says, I had live trading screens that showed the LIBOR rates in the third Wednesday of September, when the rate was supposed to be settled. That is to say, the contract was supposed to be settled. I watched those screens to see where the futures contract should settle. Shortly afterwards, the International Financial Futures Exchange in London announced the contract settlement rate. Its rate was different from what had been shown on my screens by a few hundredths of a percent. As a result, I lost money. The amount was insignificant for me, but I believed that I'd been defrauded. This is in 1991, ladies and gentlemen, and I complained to the exchange. They explained that the LIBOR rate was not determined by what rates were actually in the market. Instead, the British Bankers Association polled some banks asking them what the rates were. The highest and lowest were discarded, the rest averaged, giving the settlement rate. The exchange explained that in doing this, they were adhering to the terms of their contract. I talked to some of my more experienced colleagues about this. They told me banks misrepresented the rates in a way that would generally bring them profits. I had been unaware of that, as I was relatively new to financial trading. My naivete seemed to be humorous to my colleagues. Simply put, then, it seems the misreporting of LIBOR rates may have been common practice since at least 1991. Important is what such misreporting says about the culture. During 1991, at the London office of Morgan Stanley, the head of interest rate trading was Bob Diamond, recently resigned as head of Barclays in the LIBOR rate-fixing scandal. There have been two distinct motivations for banks to misreport these rates. One motivation is discussed above, to directly increase profits. The other motivation arose during the 2008 financial crisis, to mask liquidity problems, that is to say, the weak financial state of the banks. LIBOR misreporting has been going on for decades. Why have investigations only recently begun? It seems highly implausible that all the investigating agencies could have been unaware for decades. Indeed, those agencies have a reputation among traders of being like Potemkin villages. Look it up, kids. I suspect what has happened is that after the financial crises of 2008, the agencies decided they ought to perform more of their stated duties. That would also explain why the investigations appear to be ignoring any misreporting before 2005 to cover up the illusoriness of their earlier work. Douglas Keenan in the Financial Times. Ladies and gentlemen, and Royal Bank of Scotland Chief Executive Officer Stephen Hester took the traditional way out, blames a handful of employees for attempting to manipulate the LIBOR rate. They dismissed four employees for trying to influence the individual responsible. Following an internal investigation, the bank said, "The LIBOR issue is more to do with the wrongdoing of individuals than it is to do with a systemic problem," said Hester, contradicting what you just heard. And Berkshire Bank, a New York lender with 11 branches, sued 21 worldwide banks, including Bank of America, Barclays, and Citigroup, for damages. That's right, cue the lawsuits over the manipulation of the LIBOR rate. They sought undisclosed compensation and punitive damages and the right to represent other lenders in a group lawsuit in a filing last week. The lender claims that LIBOR fraud lowered interest payments it received. Tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars of loans are originated or sold within New York State each year with rates tied to LIBOR, they said. The banks were unable to collect the full measure of interest income to which they were entitled. They seek to represent all bank savings and loans and credit unions based in New York or have most of their operations in that state. There is one ambitious lawyer, ladies and gentlemen. LIBOR. More lie than bore. And speaking of the banks and their fine work, the Cleveland Plain Dealer reports that so-called bank walkaways are a new troubling development in the foreclosure crisis. The new F-bomb continues to explode. Particularly in cities like Cleveland with weak housing markets, lenders or mortgage companies decide they don't want homes they have already foreclosed on, sometimes because the value has plummeted, or they believe the homes could become costly liabilities if socked with housing code violations. So, without the sale, the property languishes abandoned and ripe for vandalism, good for the neighborhood. As liens and liabilities mount, creating a so-called toxic title, it becomes even harder to transfer the property. Neighborhoods and local governments are left to deal with the mess. Because, ladies and gentlemen, it's just a few, you know, few lower-level employees. We'll get the bad apples out of here, and we will get back to business. And now, we are not number one.
Whoa, that stopped fast, didn't it? And I'm over here.
Now I'm over here. We're not number one, ladies and gentlemen. Are we the world's drunkest country? We, the United States? Not even close. Now, according to the World Health Organization, 2.5 million, almost 4% of all deaths worldwide per year, I'm gathering, are because of alcohol, greater than the number of deaths caused by HIV, AIDS, violence, or tuberculosis. But we're putting people in jail for you know what. Anyway, alcohol consumption is highest in Eastern European countries, lowest in countries with high populations of Muslims, of course. So we don't get up to number one. Anyway, we're nowhere near number one. I think this list is going backwards. Ireland is number, you want to guess? 15. Ireland. France, number 16. United Kingdom, number 17. U.S., nowhere near number one. Didn't make the top 25. That's the point. Okay? So, another way that we're not number one. Couple other items you may have missed. A new study reported by Science Daily raises concern about chronic exposure of workers in industry to the food ingredient used to produce the buttery flavor and aroma of microwave popcorn, as well as the same effect in candy, baked goods, pet foods, and other products. It found evidence that the ingredient DA, intensifies the damaging effects of an abnormal brain protein linked to Alzheimer's disease. I can't believe it's not. And a Tampa Bay Times analysis of Stand Your Ground cases. Stand Your Ground are those laws that were invoked in the George Zimmerman shooting of Trayvon Martin. Remember those names? Found that it has been people with records of crime and violence who have benefited the most from the controversial legislation. A review of arrest records for those involved in more than 100 fatal Stand Your Ground cases shows nearly 60% of those who claimed self-defense had been arrested at least once before the day they killed someone. More than 30 had, about one in three, had been accused of violent crimes. Dozens had drug offenses on their records. Killers have invoked Stand Your Ground even after repeated run-ins with the law. 40% had three arrests or more. And more than a third of the defendants who invoked Stand Your Ground had previously been in trouble for threatening someone with a gun or illegally carrying a weapon. In dozens of cases, both the defendant and the victim had criminal records. Just saying. Actually, just reading. All right, ladies and gentlemen. I've dilly-dallied. I've shilly-shallied enough. You know what's going on. Let's not ignore it anymore. It's the elephant in the room. It's the Olympics. I actually went to an Olympic event this week. It was the discipline and the venue at which later in the week Rupert Murdoch was in attendance. Whew, that was a close one. But this was a different day. You see, so my record's clear. Anyway, some things you know all about: the agony of defeat and the thrill of victory. By the way, as I recall, that phrase was made popular, of course, by ABC's Wide World of Sports. And I believe it was because in those days, ABC was so poor as a network, they couldn't afford the rights to, you know, like real sports. And I don't even think they could afford the rights to the Olympics. So they figured out, well, you know, people cheer for these people who are in sports that you never hear of the rest of the time. Let's broadcast those the rest of the time. And hence Wide World of Sports, hence the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. We all know about that, but there's other stuff going on too. And that's what I want to share with you today. It became apparent this week that certain people just didn't get the memo, just enough money to the International Olympic Committee or to the London Organizing Committee. Hence, if you were going to a certain number of Olympic events, you would find out that their venue was something called North Greenwich Arena. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that building has had many names in the last decade or so. It was originally built as the Millennium Dome. You might recognize that. And after being disused for several years, it was rescued from White Elephant Hood, you know that hood, and turned into a concert venue, an event venue called the O2 Arena. But O2 is a company, a cellular telephone company, owned by the Spaniards. So if you see the Brits rooting for a Euro bailout for Spain, you'll know why they want to be able to make calls. But it's the O2 Arena. That's what everybody in London knows it as. So all of a sudden, it's the North Greenwich Arena. Now, nobody said anything, but of course, well, here, connect this to another dot. There's a blimp flying over the Olympics. A blimp with a recognizable color scheme and no words. That's right, it's the no-year blimp. Now, obviously, what's happened in both these cases is these companies just wouldn't pony up to the Olympics. Hey, we paid for the naming rights to the building. We own the blimp. What do you want? Well, you know what they want. So, no-name buildings, no-name blimps. The other thing that really strikes you when you go to these events, I mentioned last week the opening ceremony had like a warm-up, like a 45-minute warm-up. If you've ever been to the taping of a TV show, you know what that's like. Hey, guys, all right, let's hear you all cheer. Let's hear you all laugh. Okay, be sure to do that real loud for the mic, you know that. Ooh. Anyway, that. Well, yes, there is that. but also in attendance all over the place are the Olympic mascots. Have you seen the Olympic mascots, ladies and gentlemen? They are cyclopses. They are one-eyed creatures. They, not only are they all over the venues, remember that fad in America when fish would show up painted in different colors all over town? I think this started with cows in Chicago, but then it spread. And it's, you know, it's art. It's art. Well, now these cyclopses are showing up all over London, painted in different things, different raiment. But they're all cyclopses. You know, I know that the Olympic mascots are meant to appeal to children. Remember Sam the Olympic Eagle? But I'm close enough to my child mind to think, that scares the out of me. And the only thing that would scare me more is if it was a clown cyclops. I'm going to have nightmares just for having said that. The other thing that you don't really get from watching the Olympics on television is the barrage of sound. Now, as I say, the warm-up is bad enough. But they really don't trust you to know how to respond just because you're at the Olympic Games and paid probably some money for the privilege. So they're constantly telling you, stand up and cheer and show your respect for these great athletes at these great Olympic Games. They're doing that for a good reason, though. Because they have decided that between every actual moment of eventing, and who turned that into a verb? Somebody in the equestrian business, I guess. There shouldn't be silence or an opportunity for you to say, hey, how about that swim? Did you see what they... They play loud music from a selection provided by Universal Music, the exclusive music, loud music contributor, provider for the Olympic Games. So creating, therefore, the unique international ambience of a Venice t-shirt shack. Venice Beach, that is. So, of course, the guy has to keep reminding you you're at the Olympics because it doesn't sound like you're at the Olympics. It sounds like a Venice Beach t-shirt shack. Well, that's all. Those are my observations. Now, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersol, Jr. On a related subject, London 2012 organizers say they will review the use of loud music in the main Olympic Stadium. They're confident that they've got the level about right. During the women's 10,000-meter final, there were some complaints that the pumping dance music soundtrack was detracting from the action. A spokeswoman for the organizing committee said the use of music had been cleared by the international federations and had received loads of really positive feedback about the atmosphere in the venues. LOCOG, the organizing committee, says it plans to use music presenters and films to help explain the sports and deliver an entertaining experience. Because I guess the Olympics is not entertaining enough. It worked with Universal Music to divide 2,000-plus songs into five distinct playlists, themed to provide the most appropriate soundtrack to each sport. LOCOG says there's been a conscious attempt to ramp up the way various sports are presented. Way to believe in your mission, babe. 8 years after the 2004 Athens Games, we talked about Beijing, many of the Olympic venues Greece built at great expense remain abandoned or rarely used. They are the focus of great public anger as the company struggles through a fifth year of recession. At the Southern Athens venue for softball, a sport unknown in Greece and already out of the Olympics, the occasional weed is all that remains on the dried-out field. With no shortage of real beaches, the purpose-built beach volleyball stadium has seen minimal use in the past 8 years, an occasional concert. Concerts on the sand. The Badminton Hall has been converted into a popular theater venue. The former broadcast center is a shopping mall. The old baseball venue has been used by a 4th Division local soccer club, although it's deteriorating. The hockey venue hosted the Special Olympics last year, but material used in that event still lies abandoned around the rim. Is that a view of the future in London? Spectators tweeting and using social media contributed to the shambolic television coverage of the men's road race last week. With 1 million people lining the roads for the Olympic race, the mobile network used by broadcasters became jammed by the cellular traffic, preventing organizers from receiving crucial timing and GPS updates. An IOC spokesman suggested spectators watching road races should only send urgent social media updates to avoid repeats. Teams from Japan, China, South Korea, and Indonesia all tried to avoid winning at the Olympics on July 31st. Japan was the only one to get away with it. The Japanese soccer team fielded a weaker squad against South Africa and played for a tie as the country tried to sidestep a victory that would have meant a long trip for a match with tougher opponents. But four pairs of badminton players from China, South Korea, and Indonesia wanted to extend their chances of Olympic glory. They found themselves tossed out in a rare expulsion. Everybody is required to play their best every time they go on court, said the Badminton World Federation Secretary General. The players' actions drew jeers from spectators at Wembley Arena. They were disqualified after a five-hour meeting. The IOC views the games as part of the larger movement. And the Olympic movement aspires to bring nations together to reflect the core values of the brand, which is sportsmanship and competition. And ethics is rolled into that, says Paul Swangard, managing director of the Sports Marketing Center at the University of Oregon. This particular case strikes at the heart of that equity that the IOC works very hard to preserve and protect. But if you watched the pentathlon yesterday, ladies and gentlemen, you learned a new term, as I did, the domestique, a competitor who's not there to win, but merely to somehow contribute to the potential for victory of another member of the same team. I know, it's ironic. It's the Olympics. The Chinese badminton star is apparently quitting the sport after she was one of the eight players disqualified. "This is my last game," she tweeted. "Farewell, Badminton World Federation. Farewell, my dear badminton." The Chinese Olympic delegation criticized its players' actions. "It violated the Olympics' ideal in the spirit of fair play. The Chinese delegation feels distressed over this matter." And the head coach said, "As the head coach, I owe the fans and the Chinese an apology. It's me to blame." Nike continues to think on its feet during the Olympics, says Advertising Age. It's created a fast turnaround ad featuring Paula Radcliffe, the British marathon hope who pulled out of today's race due to a foot injury. A print ad featuring Miss Radcliffe holding the Union Jack aloft and the words, "Legends run forever," reclaimed her as a Nike athlete. She pulled out of the marathon July 29th when she was still bound by IOC rules preventing her from promoting her association with the non-Olympic sponsor, because the Olympic sponsor is Adidas. The image from the Nike ad was first tweeted immediately after she announced she would not run. When asked if Nike had any similar ads ready to run, a spokesman said the company does not share future marketing plans. And personally, I was in a couple of neighborhoods in London this week, central London, Covent Garden, and a couple other neighborhoods. And what I heard universally from shop owners is, this is killing us. I tweeted a photograph of an absolutely empty street midweekday in Covent Garden, which you never see except when it snows. And then the torrent of reporting began. The Financial Times says the Olympics is creating a ghost town effect in central London as visitors who would normally shop to the flock to the shops, hotels, and theaters stay away, casting doubt on expectations of an economic boost from the Games during what is, of course, Britain's double-dip recession. The Olympics have attracted as many as 100,000 visitors, foreign visitors. That number significantly lags behind the estimated 300,000 foreign tourists who typically come to London every year. "We're bleeding, darling," says the chief executive of a chain of legitimate theaters. "Last week was the worst of the year. I feel like I've been the bullseye for the archery competition." Record store I talked to said sales are down 30%, like record stores can afford that. In Leicester Square, says the CBC in Canada, a few families sit enjoying urban picnics while salespeople try to drum up business. The gloom is repeated across London's major tourist attractions. The London Zoo says it has 40% fewer visitors than during the same period a year earlier. Business Week says London hotel shops, restaurants, and major attractions are losing sales as visitors heed warnings of overcrowding in the capital from Mayor Boris Johnson. "They've listened to warnings," says director of the European Tour Operators Association, "and they're staying away." And The Guardian reports that London retailers are asking the government to remind the public their shops are still open for business, but it's not just London that's been hit by the Olympics. The number of shoppers on main streets outside London have fallen as well. It's a movement, ladies and gentlemen. And we all need one. Every day.
Says you'd be a fool to stay. Games lanes are unoccupied, empty seats galore. This would be a great event to locate on a moor. February looks like this, but not July or May. It's a faux snow day. Just a faux snow. Visitors are here to see a show, paid for by the taxes of the people down below. Is there a bonanza here that just cannot be seen? Or has the town been run round through the scam machine? Snow jobs cover everything, especially feet of clay, on a faux snow day. On a faux snow.
This is Le Show from London. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Tales of Airport Security. Kim writes, I have a groin anomaly. Who knew? I'm not quite sure what it is, but that's what airport security told me. It was a Saturday night. I'd worked all day, 2,500 miles from home, and was eager to get through security so I could get my plane home. I was tired, someone had yelled at me at the end of the workday, and I just wanted to grab a drink before my flight. But no. I was selected for the full body scan. Must be my 5'4" gray hair and business suit, on a Saturday night, no less. So I spread my legs on the shoe pads, clearly a leg spread drawn by a 6'6 guy, and raised my arms with just the appropriate elbow bend. Yes, my hair barrette was suspicious. I'd experienced that before. My head was patted down. Then my bra had metal wires in it, so I got my bra edges rubbed. I'd had this once or twice as well. I'm reading this, ladies and gentlemen. I don't wear a bra. But then, Kim continues, something more was wrong. They rubbed little swabs of cloth over me. Someone grabbed up my belongings, and I was shuffled off to the private room with two women security guards. They carefully explained how they were going to rub all over me using the back of their hands or the side. I'm not sure why the front or the back matters. One woman did the full body scan, focusing on my groin area, while the other woman held my belongings tight. Then the questioning began. What do I have in my groin? Do you have a pad on? No, I'm 56 and beyond all that. Finally, I asked, what's the problem? The answer? You have a groin anomaly. What does one say? I never knew I had a groin anomaly. Perhaps because I've had kids, I'm not overly concerned about modesty. I offered just to take my slacks off. They said I didn't have to, but they wanted me to think again whether I had something special down there. Finally, I said, look, I have underpants, and I dropped my trousers. The ladies thanked me very much and shuffled me out of the room. No apologies, no nothing. The lesson? Be careful of those groin anomalies. A tale of airport security from Kim, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Well, what's the Army Corps of Engineers up to these days? God knows they're trying. Their motto, of course, is let us try. So let's let them. Sex, booze, and a taxpayer-funded vacation to Bali and Singapore, all a part of salacious allegations of bid rigging and fraud involving the Omaha District of the Army Corps. No criminal charges filed in the federal investigation. It centers on a program manager in the Omaha District and his dealings with an Oregon company, Sky Research, specializing in aerial surveys of old military properties to find weapon debris. They didn't tell you that job existed when you went to school, did they? Affidavits filed in court depict a cozy relationship between the program manager of the Corps and the company's owners, Sky, who goes by one name, and his wife, Ann Sky. The program manager of the Corps was allegedly wined and dined in exchange for confidential information that helped the company secure federal contracts worth millions of dollars. And several environmental groups interested in the Atchafalaya Basin have blasted the Army Corps of Engineers for continuing projects and policies that are drying up wetlands in the basin. Well, the Corps wouldn't do that. They love wetlands. In a comment on the Corps' Atchafalaya Basin Master Plan, nonprofit citizens groups accused the agency of merely paying lip service to its stated goal to retain and restore the unique environmental features of the floodway. The letter of comment contains a list of actions and inactions contributing to the accumulation of sand and silt in the lakes and wetlands in the Atchafalaya Basin, which is, if you may know, is west of the Mississippi. Atchafalaya Basin keeper Dean Wilson says Corps permits for private projects that degrade the swamps are easy to come by and are often granted after the fact. The penalty for catching an undersized bass or not wearing a life jacket is way bigger than for building illegal dams, roads through the wetlands, and any other illegal activities affecting waterways and wetlands, he writes. For more information on that kind of work by the Corps, try the book Paving Paradise, which follows the Corps in its attempts to prevent any loss to the wetlands of Florida. That worked out well. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
The BBC has had to apologize for its coverage of Olympic cycling after it was savaged by viewers angry at repeated mistakes, poor audio, and lack of graphics. The BBC's team repeatedly made mistakes. Presenter Jake Humphrey apologized for background noise during his presentations, claiming the problem had been out of the BBC's control. Gary Lineker, who's presenting much of the games, also apologized for the camera work, tweeting, "This is the Olympics. The coverage is from a pool of broadcasters from across the world. I'm afraid that's how it is, regardless of who hosts." Yeah, that's right. Blame the world. HSBC, the British bank accused of helping drug lords in Mexico launder money. Hey, gets it clean. Apologized to investors for compliance failings and set aside $2 billion more to cover the costs of fines and redress. It's already set aside $1.3 billion in the first half to compensate British clients wrongly sold payment protection insurance. It also made a $700 million provision for U.S. fines after the Senate committee found the bank gave terrorists, drug cartels, and criminals access to the U.S. financial system. That sum may increase, according to Chief Executive Officer Stuart Gulliver.
Sorry.
Although none of those people will be going to jail. Because they apologize. A top White House aide has apologized to a prominent conservative columnist after a public spat over the status of the bust of former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. The White House Communications Director Dan Pfeiffer conceded Tuesday, quote, "I clearly overshot the runway by declaring that Charles Krauthammer's claim that the bust of Churchill had been returned to the British Embassy was 100% false." Pfeiffer denounced the claim, saying the bust remained at the White House. Well, it turns out there are two busts. One was returned on Inauguration Day, as Krauthammer said. The other remained in the White House residence. "I take your criticism seriously, and you are correct that you were owed an apology," said Pfeiffer. "There was clearly an internal confusion about the two busts. There was no intention to deceive. A better understanding of the facts on my part and a couple of deep breaths at the outset would have prevented this situation," he wrote. Second apology in 2 weeks for Twitter. They've apologized for a mess-up surrounding the suspension of journalist Guy Adams from the British newspaper The Independent, who used tweets to criticize Olympics coverage by the company's business partner, NBC. Twitter blocked his account after he posted the work email address of NBC Olympics president Gary Zenkel, urging people to complain about the network delaying broadcasts of events. Twitter said some of its staff, working with NBC, identified the tweet as a violation of its terms of use, and then encouraged the broadcaster to report the violation.
Sorry.
Twitter said in posting Zenkel's corporate email address, Adams was sharing something he deemed to be public. But Twitter says those distinctions aren't always clear, since people use their corporate email address for private purposes sometimes. Don't tell the bosses. The organizers of the Olympic Games also apologized to the Indian contingent over the issue of an unidentified woman gate-crashing into the team's march past at the opening ceremony. Angry at the mystery woman's presence, the Indian contingent had shot off a letter to the Games organizers, who have apologized. I believe the woman herself has apologized as well. U.S. officials apologized this week for mistakenly leaving a fake bomb attached to an embassy vehicle in Oslo, Norway, and causing a bomb scare that led to the evacuation of the embassy, as well as Norway's Royal Palace and part of downtown Oslo. Fencing's governing body is offering South Korean Shin Alam a special sportsmanship medal following her controversial elimination this week. A day after a weeping Shin staged a one-hour protest and had to be escorted off the fencing strip following her semifinal loss to Germany's Britta Heidemann. Korean Olympic Committee President Park Yong-sung said the federation recognized there were issues with timekeeping and apologized. They never expected this kind of thing to happen in the last second. Three attacks. Their timekeeping machine is only in seconds, not tenths of a second, he said. Because of this, they could not handle the situation correctly. He also forgot to mention that the timekeeper hired for the event was a 15-year-old volunteer. The World Wrestling Entertainment Company has issued a full apology after an on-air personality joked that one of the wrestlers was, quote, like Kobe Bryant at a hotel in Colorado, he's unstoppable. Really, something in bad taste on wrestling? And NBC has apologized for advertising an interview with American swimming sensation Missy Franklin before showing her actual gold medal race. Oh, and the Democratic campaign officials who had issued press statements alleging that Sheldon Adelson, Las Vegas hotel magnate, had supported and profited from prostitution in his Macau casinos, they've apologized for those allegations. And yes, the Indian woman who gate-crashed has apologized for an error of judgment. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A new U.S. government report has found major reconstruction projects in Afghanistan are so behind schedule, they will not yield results before most combat troops leave. The report by the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction states the Afghan government will not have the money or skills to maintain many of the projects. Quote, implementing projects that the Afghan government is unable to sustain may be counterproductive to the U.S. counterinsurgency mission, the Inspector General suggests, and that may affect the whole hearts and minds thing. We may get hearts and no minds, or vice versa. Who needs that? If goals are set and not achieved, both the U.S. and Afghan governments can lose the populace's support, he writes. Of course, if we're out, we don't really need the support of the Afghan populace, but the Afghan government, well, you never know. The analysis examines the Afghan Infrastructure Fund, which was authorized by Congress way back in 2010. Over the past 2 years, you and I, ladies and gentlemen, I'm proud to say, have invested $800 million in that fund. And the State Department has committed about $1 billion of its funds to related infrastructure programs. The report suggests that Washington may have attempted to build too much in a country with limited maintenance resources, like the diesel fuel that would need to operate the electric plants we built for them. That's the gratitude, you see? They don't even want to buy the diesel fuel. The U.S. Embassy in Kabul called the document speculative, meaning, I guess, they're going to be buying investments based on it. The News of Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe. The USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world, the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave, where you'll find the number stations. On the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it. HarryShearer.com and KCRW.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through KCRW.com. It'd be just like the Olympics being over in a week if you'd get joined with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. A chip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Hawaii, and Chicago desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. And thanks to Adrian Bodders, here at Global Radio in London, for helping with today's broadcast. This broadcast is represented on Twitter. Join the nearly 66,000 whatevers at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the Rubber Promise and the homeless. So long from London.